Okay, we finished off in the Gemara at the bottom of Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Bet. If you look in the Tosfot, there at the bottom right of Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Bet, he already raises the issue that there might be some issue about what should follow here in the Gemara. What we have in our Gemara is the next Mishnah that follows, but there's a Gemara that actually uses the Mishnah that we just did, which is Nafala Bayit Alav V'Alav Viv, and that Mishnah is used as a proof text for one of the next series of Gemaras. So the Tosos quoted over here, but the Rashbam is actually on Kuf Nun Chen Amud Bet, says that the next piece of the Gemara should not be what we have at the top of Kuf Nun Chet Amud Aleph, which is the Mishnah, but rather should be the Gemara that continues on the bottom of Kuf Nun Chet Amud Bet. So what we're going to do is we're just going to go to that Gemara, follow through the that Gemara to its conclusion, which is part of the Mishnah that we just finished, and then we'll come back and do the Mishnah here on the beginning of Kuf Nun Chet, and then finish the rest of Kuf Nun Chet and Kuf Nun Tet tomorrow. So if you look in the bottom of Kuf Nun Chet Amud Bet, it's four lines from the bottom. Four lines from the bottom of Kuf Nun Chet Amud Bet, it says, Shalchu Mitam. They sent from over there, so they sent the question, Ben Shalava B'Nichsei Aviv, a son that borrowed in his father's possessions, b'chayei aviv, while his father was still alive, umet, and then passed away. B'no motzi miyad ha-lukuchot. His son can take from the lukuchot. V'zuhi ish kasheh b'dinei memonot. This is a really difficult case, or not really clearly understandable case, in dinei memonot. So the Gemara says, first of all, the whole case itself is somewhat ambiguous. It's not really understandable. He says, Loveh, my mapik. The loveh is, what are you taking from? Oh, the kuchot, my vitei. And where are their buyers over here? The case never mentioned any buyers that he's taking away. And the loveh, what is he taking? Anyway, what's he coming to take? Or what's he taking on behalf? So the case itself is not easy to understand. And that's what the Gemara says. Ella, idmar och idmar. If you want to say it, this is what you should say. Now that's the girsa that we have in our Gemara, that this is what the case should be. Tosus, on the other hand, says that the Girsha should either read Ikasha, Haikasha. If there's something problematic, this is what's problematic. And that's because the Gemara is now going to go through a series of questions that were Shachumitam, a series of questions that were sent from over there. And all of them, as Tosus says, were really sent. These are all real questions, and these are all real cases. The only question the Gemara has is the concluding statement over here with Zuhi Shekasheh B'dinei Memonot. This is what's difficult in the case of Dinei Memonot. So what the Gemara is going to do is going to go through each of these cases that were sent from there and figure out why it's difficult or what doesn't make sense about the position that we take or the halacha that is established in these cases. But not that the cases didn't happen, not that the cases aren't understandable. It could be that the Itmar Hachi Itmar is only referencing this first one because the Lashon that we had in the Shalchu Mitam is a little unclear. And it's ambiguous, and therefore the Gemara is trying to get to a clearer statement. All the other statements are clear. What the case is, the question only revolves around whether it's really a Kasheh B'dinim Emonot. So Yitmar, this is what you're going to say. Ben Shemachar B'nechseh Aviv. A son who sold his father's possession, B'chayei Aviv, while his father was still alive. Umeit. And then he passes away. Bino, his son, Motzi miyad alukuchot. He takes away from the purchasers. V'huzuhi shekasheh b'dinim mamonot. This is a difficult position in b'dinim mamonot. Why? Simulei avuach mezavin v'at meifik. Your father sells and you get it back. So the case here is you have Reuven, Yaakov, his father, and Reuven's children, Chanoch ufalu. So Reuven goes ahead, and while Yaakov, his father, is still alive, he transacts in his father's property. He's basically selling his father's property forward and saying, when I inherit this property, you are purchasing it from me. So that's the one possibility. Tosus also explains the possibility that the case over here is a case that we've seen before where the individual, Reuven, already was granted the property by his father, Yaakov. But he says, Meyom, right, Oliach Mita, it's from today and after Mita. So he gets the, right, he gets the Karen right now, he owns the Karka now, but he won't get the payroad until his father passes away. So then he went ahead again and sold the property before his father had passed away. And when he sells the property before his father passes away, and then he passes away, instead of his father predeceasing him, he passes away first. And when he passes away first, then the inheritance is no longer going to come to him. But his son, Chanuch Ufalu, come along, and they inherit from their grandfather, Yaakov. So now what happens? These lukuchot, these purchasers bought from Reuven the rights to the property. And then all of a sudden, Reuven's sons, Chanoch and Falu, come along and they take the property. So what did the buyers say? The buyers say, wait, how did you get this property? You got this property because of your father Reuven. Your father Reuven is set to inherit from his father Yaakov, from our grandfather. And since it's passing through Reuven, that means that he, at some point, got the property. We own it because we bought it from him. And then why is it going to you? Why are you taking this away from us? How could it be? So where is this? My kushya. Why is this such a difficult thing to understand? Dilma Matsiyamar Mikochavua Da'abo Katino. They can say we are inheriting this directly from our grandfather. It's not that it passes through our father Reuven, but we are entitled heirs over here. Entitled heirs in the sense that we step into our father's shoes. So we've seen this a number of times in Yerusha, that Yerusha may not function in the sense that it's passed down. Even though Reuven's passed away, that it passes to Reuven and then passes to his children. But rather that the children of Reuven become Reuven. They can step into shoes and become Reuven. If they do that, then they are direct inheritors from Yaakov. And Reuven is never a part of the picture. He never touches the property. So then, makes sense. Teda, I can show you that, Tichtiv. Because it says in Tehillim, Tacha tabutecha yu banecha, tishitemo l'sarim b'chol aretz. Right, instead of your fathers, you will be the children. I mean, referring to the grandchildren, that instead of your fathers, you will be the children of your grandparents. So, tishitemo l'sarim b'chol aretz, that you'll make them princes amongst the whole land. So you see that their reference to the grandchild as being a child. So, what do we say? Bnei banim, harayim kibanim. So, bnei banim, harayim kibanim means that you can step in as a yoresh and be a replacement yoresh. So now there's a question of whether this is only applicable, right? In the Rishonim question, it's only applicable to Bnei Banim. And this is a unique circumstance that Bnei Banim, Harayim Kibanim, and therefore they step into the shoes of their father. Or if this is true of any Yoresh who comes from the Koach of his Morish, does he then become like the Morish? Or no, this is a unique circumstance that has to do with Bnei Banim. So, Ela Ikasha, Hakasha. If you want to say there's another case, this should be the case that is difficult. Ben Bichor. Shemachar Chelik Bichora B'chaye Aviv. The eldest child, a Bichor, goes ahead and sells his Chelik in the Bichora while his father was still alive. Umate! And then he dies. This Bichor. B'chaye Aviv, while his father was still alive. Beno Motsiyu Miyad Alukuhod. His son takes it away from the purchasers. Vizui Kashib Dini Mimonaras. Again, this is a very difficult case. In Dine Memononos. So what, here it's a little different, right? Because it's the exact same case as before, which is that the son sold, before his father died, sold the property. And by selling the property ahead, they basically were betting on the fact that if the father would pass away, he would inherit it. Yaakov would pass away, Reuven would inherit it, and they would be the buyers of that property. But instead, Reuven passes away first, and the children, Chanoch and Falu, his children come along and say they take all the property and they bump out the lukuchot. So Gemara says, "Zui kashu b'dinim melot, avua mezavin iu meipik." The father does the transaction. Reuven sells and buys, and iu meipik, and the children Chanoch and Falu go ahead and take the property out. So what are you going to say? Well, this is exactly like the case we just had before. Amar b'koach avua da'aba katino. This is the exact same case. Bnei banim harim bnei banim. And they're just stepping into their father's shoes. So now, wait a minute. That doesn't work. Why? Because if you say your only rights to this property are you're directly inheriting from your grandfather, then why should you get any chelek b'chora? The chelek b'chora is only generated by the son. And so it has to be that the son's rights are what are being picked up by the grandchildren over here, because otherwise they don't have any chelek in the b'chora. If they're inheriting directly from their grandfather, they should be on equal footing with all the other brothers, because they just replaced their father, and now they're just like one of the other brothers. Why should they be classified as a b'chor if it never touches their father? Oh, this is what we have been describing until now. When we say that we're inheriting directly from the grandfather, it doesn't mean that we, you know, in a direct sense, are inheriting, that our father doesn't exist. No, but rather we become our father. We take on the status of our father. We step into his shoes, and now we become him. So we garner any rights that he has, we now have. But not that it goes to him, not that he's involved, but we have now entitled to any rights that he would have otherwise had, we're also entitled to. And we know that. Where do we know that from? We've seen this before by Benot Slavchad. It said in the Mishnah by Benot Slavchad, that they were entitled to the chelek b'chor of their father, of Tzlavchad, even though Tzlavchad had passed away. So why are they entitled to the chelek habechor? Because they step into his shoes. They become like their father, and therefore they're entitled to the chelek habechor. So what you have to say is that b'malkum uvein avi ani omeit, I'm stepping into my father's shoes, kiel ani bechor, as if I am the bechor, gzeres hakatuv. That is the gzeres hakatuv. That children step into their father's shoes and become like their father for all their rights. Not that it's passing through them, but they gain all the rights that they had. And then again, so then why is this such a difficult case to understand? So now the Gemara is going to try to find another possible case. Elo ikasha hakasha. This was the difficult case that they said. Haya yodeilo edut bishtar, achlo nase gazlan. He knew testimony about that which was in a document, in a contract, before he became a gazlan. Vinase gazlan. And then afterwards he becomes a gazlan. Who? Eno me'id al ktav yado. He can no longer testify about his handwriting in the document. So you have a shtar here that has that he's either signed on or that his handwriting is found in it. And he wants to testify to the veracity of the document. So how do you testify the veracity of the document? You say, this is my signature. I signed on the document. The problem is that before he got a chance to say that it was my signature on the document, he was a gazlan. And once he's a gazlan, he's pasul de edut. If he's pasul de edut, he can't testify about his handwriting anymore. On the other hand, aval acherim me'idim. If other people come along and say, we recognize his handwriting, go ahead, you can testify on it. Here, he's not believed about his own handwriting, but other people are going to be believed about his handwriting. This is a very difficult case in Dine Mimononot. What's the difficulty over here? The difficulty is that there are two possibilities, right, about why we worry about a gazlan testifying about a contract. Why do we worry about a gazlan testifying about a contract? Well, one possibility is that there was a document a long time ago, and he signed on it. And when he signed on it, he was not a gazlan. And when he signed on it, it could have been fine that it was true, and everything was fine. The other possibility is that he's actually forged the entire document, and now he's showing up in court. So our problem is, now, if we have a cherim testifying about his signature, true, if the document was written before he was a gazlan, no problem. Because maybe he can't testify about his own handwriting because he's not trustworthy anymore. But when the contract was signed, he was trustworthy. And therefore, the other edim coming from the outside and testifying about it, fine. But what do you say about a contract that now he's bringing before us? The other possibility of the forgery is that he actually forged the document currently. After he was a gazlan, he forged the document with a date prior to him becoming a gazlan.
In order to validate the document,
right, but he's... Maybe that would help you out, right? That could help you out in that instance. But if not, if he's the only, if he's the aide or he has someone else testifying about both of the signatures, right? Then it's a question mark about the veracity of the document. Not again, because if he was a gazlan, it would be trustworthy. If that makes sense, the problem is that it could be forged currently. If it's forged currently, and we get a deem to testify his handwriting, it's true, it's his handwriting. It's fine, it is his signature, but the whole document is false. So what are you going to do about that? So Gemara says, oh, my kushya. That sounds so difficult. His ktav yado was already known or well established in the Beis Din. What does that mean? So according to the Rashbam, it means that they had a henpek. There was a henpek on the document. A henpek is a Beis Din, you know, one of those seal of approvals, right, from the, sorry the dining, but it's just an approval that says, stamp that this, we saw this in Beis Din, it was here beforehand. So if they stamp it, that's good enough. Because that's all happened before he was a gazlan. That happened before he was determined to be a gazlan. So now, if individuals come and testify to his signature, we don't have to worry about the second issue. Oh, so that's a good question about what the henpek does, right? The henpek only testifies to the fact that the document exists and Beis Din saw it. Question: what it testifies about? About the signatures or the signatories on the document is questionable, and that's what Tosfos asks over here. If you look in Tosfos, it says, Gon Shkuksak Tabdil be Beis Din, says, Perish Rabbeinu Shmuel, Shekata bo Henpek. They have this seal of approval from Beis Din. Vein Nero Lari, De'enach Dayanim Gufayo Milo Matzi Limite. Who says that the Dayanim themselves couldn't have been tricked? Right? Baha'u Gafro, I Gazlan Hu, Ilo Shari Ein Chotmim, Ilo Al Chatimat Eidim, Vafilo Mashi Bishtar, and Tzuchim Adayim Likrot. Number one is, he could have forged the document and brought the document here. And they say, yeah, we know this is his signature. Everything's fine. The document looks fine. But they don't even have to read. When they give a henpek in Beis Din, they don't read the contents of the document. They're just trying to say that the document was brought before us and we saw it and everything is fine. He says, what does it mean that chukzak, ktav yod be'beis din, shra'u beis din ktav yodo kodem shenaseh gazlan? Beis din saw his ktav yodo, they saw evidence to his handwriting, or they saw the document before he became a gazlan. To never say, because of the two possibilities of cheating over here is that, one, again, that he lied when he signed the document originally, or that he forged the whole document, he's bringing it before us after he was a gazlan. So all we want to do is eliminate the possibility of it being a forged document. So if Beis Din already saw the document prior to him becoming a gazlan, then we don't have a question anymore. Because the document was already seen, or his ktav yado was already known before he was a gazlan, then we know for sure he didn't forge the document now. The only question was, was he the witness, or is it a valid document when he brought it? That he can't testify to, but someone else could, because we're testifying about prior to him becoming a gazlan. So Tosfos says simply that it's that Beis Din knows about the document or his signature before he became a gazlan. The Rishbam claims that it's a hempek already. There's a hempek that comes out of Beis Din before he was a gazlan. And therefore, when they are made over here on the signatures of the hempek, they're not testifying about his signature, they're testifying about the hempek. And the hempek, by definition, or memela, makes the other document the kosher document. So it's not that they're testifying directly on his signature on the document. The edim are testifying about the veracity of the hempek. When they testify about the veracity of the hempek, that automatically, right, validates the other document. And so they're not testifying about his signature. So just like he's not believed about his signature, they're not believed about his signature. They're believed about the hempek or the other signature on the document. And memela, by definition, the other document becomes valid because of the hempek that exists. Man, that's the two ways to explain it. Now, Gemara says, Eli Yikash Akash. This is the difficult case. Aya yodea lo be'edut. He knew testimony for this individual. Ad shelo naseh chatano. Before he became his son-in-law. Benaseh chatano. And then he became his son-in-law. Hu eino me'id al-ktav yodo. He can no longer testify about his own signature. Aval acheri me'idim. He can't, but others can testify about his signature, that it was a good signature. Hulo mehemin, achrina mehemne. He's not believed, and others are believed. Now he became a nogeh badavar. He became a relative. He became a son-in-law. So he's no longer allowed to testify about his signature on the document that's the benefit of his father-in-law. So he's now precluded from establishing the veracity of his signature. Yet other people can come along and establish the veracity of his signature. Gemara says, so what are you going to suggest? The same answer we did before. It's kagon shehuchzak tavdo v'do v'beis din. The Beis Din already knows about his signature. I mean, again, like Tosfos says, either the document's already been presented in Beis Din, or going to Rashbam, that there's a henpek that they're testifying about. Even this case is even in a case where we don't have chuzak yado v'beis din. So we have here explicit statement from Yosef Bar Yumi that says that's not the case. The case here is even in a case where it's not chuzak yado, and nevertheless, what do we say? He's not believed about his handwriting or about his signature, yet others will be believed about it. So what is it? Mar says, "My kushya. What do you mean? We can solve this problem. Zirma gzerat hamelech hi. It's gzeras hakotuv. Why? Diula mehemen, that he's not believed. Vachrine mehemne, and others are believed. V'la mishum de mishaker. The problem here is not a problem of lying or the possibility that he would lie. Diilo temahochi. If you don't say this, Moshe v'Aaron lechutnam. Right, for Moshe and Aaron to testify for their fathers-in-law, they can't testify for their fathers-in-law because we don't trustworthy, they're not trustworthy. So Gzeret HaMelech, that you're not allowed to testify for relatives. So it's over here, there's a Gzeret HaMelech, that you're not allowed to testify for the Ktav Yado of your father-in-law. Right? And therefore, the problem or the psak here is not a psak of logic, right? It's a psak of gzeres hakatuv. So you can't say it's kasher b'dinei mamonot because it's not a logical argument. It's simply gzeres hakatuv that you're not believed in these instances. Now what you see over here is that there's actually a difference between the two cases. In the case of the gazlan, we're worried about two possibilities. The two possibilities by the gazlan is one is that, again, that he signed it earlier and that he was lying when he originally signed it, or that he forged a dark document currently. On the other hand, by relatives, by chudno, we're not worried about the fact that he forged the document currently. We're only worried about the fact that when he signed it earlier, right, there's a possibility maybe that it wasn't truthworthy or that he had some sort of relationship with him. So why is it by a gazlan that we worry about those two possibilities? By a son-in-law, we don't worry about the fact that he forged the entire document. So the answer to that is that it's only because he's a rasha, a gazlan. A gazlan loses his nemanut. When he loses his nemanut in dinei mamonos, then we start to worry about that other possibility. We learn about one possibility is that he originally signed that it was invalid, or that his testimony, when he comes to court to testify about his signature, he's lying because he's now a gazlan, so we don't trust him. We also worry about the possibility that he has forged the entire document, and it's a totally false document that he's bringing to court now. Why? Because he's a gazlan. He's not trustworthy in dinei mamonos. On the other hand, by a relative, by a son-in-law or a father-in-law, what do we say? We say it's a gzera takatuv that they cannot testify about their signature. It doesn't have to do with a lack of nemanut. It doesn't have to do with the fact we don't believe them or we think they're lying. That is the gzera takatuv that may not testify. So now, when we talk about what we worry about, we only worry about the fact that they're testifying about items that were signed before, and whether, you know, maybe by relatives we say that it's not, I mean, the gzera takatuv is whether you're believed or not believed, you still can't do it. Meaning there's an objective standard. It doesn't matter whether you're believable or not believable. You can't do it. But what we're not going to do is worry about the fact that he forged the entire document. That's not a suspicion that we're going to have about a relative, because the whole problem with the relative is not about his being mishaker, about his being lying over here. So based on that, you actually have now cases in the middle. What happens if the individual is classified as a pasul eidut, but not because he lied or not because of dinei mamonot? He did something else, right? He did something, he violated some isur that makes him a pasul eidut. But pasul eidut, not because we worry about him being pasul like a gazlan, where he steals. Stealing is that we don't trust him anymore with money. We don't trust him about, you know, other people's possessions. We don't trust him to testify the truth. But over here, say isur, he ate chalev, he did some isur, he violated some isur, doraisa, makes him pasul eidut. So now when he's pasul eidut, right, that pasul eidut is not deriving from his lack of trustworthiness. It's more like akin to the case of the relative. So that's the question amongst the Achronim. By that case, are we choshesh for the forged document or not? By the relative, it's clear we don't worry about it. By Gazlan, it's clear we do worry about it. For these cases that you have psul eidut that sits in between those two categories, do we worry about the forged document? And that's subject to machlokas Achronim, whether that person is classified like the Rasha, and if we don't believe him entirely, even about, you know, that we worry about a forged document, or no, it's simply an issue of Gzeirat HaKetuv that he's pasul, and therefore if others come and testify on his behalf, it would work. So that's what happens. That's the difference. The case of the relative, if others testify on behalf, it works. In the case of Gazlan, others testify, it does not work. It only works if it's Chukzak V'Bezdin. And so that difference, does it apply by a case of Psul Eidut for other reasons? That was what we just discussed. Is right. So now the Gemara says, all right, so now what's the now we don't know what the case is that they had difficulty with. What is this case that they have to deal with? So in the end, the Gemara says, Ela the olam kedamrina mikara. Must be that which we said originally. Uda kakashalach, tachavavutecha yuvanecha. What did you say before? The first case that we brought was a case where the grandchildren inherit the grandfather, and they say they basically bypass the father. By bypassing the father, the buyers get nothing, because the father never got any property that they bought, so therefore they bypass the kuchot. Say, why is that so difficult? Bnei banim, harayek banim, we have an explicit pasuk in Tehillim that says that. What's the difficulty with the logic? Why is it in the kasher b'dinim emonot? So my answer is up. Well, the pasuk in Tehillim is, the kasher l'cha, tachar b'techi u'benecha, hau b'brocha k'tiv. That's a brocha. What's the brocha? So the brocha is either, according to the Rishbam, the brocha is that tzadikim have banim u'bnei banim, that tzadikim have children and grandchildren, meaning that they have, that their, right, offspring continue. The other possibility is what Tosfos says, that Shmin and Kosh, Yiski Atzarik the Banim Kemoto. That he'll have grandchildren just like him, because what's the end of the Pasuk? Right, the end of the Pasuk is Tishitemo, the Sarim Becholaritz. There'll be princes in the whole land. So just like the grandfather is a Tzadik, his grandchildren will also be placed as princes amongst the land, meaning that they will also be like their grandfather. So Gemara says that the Pasuk in Tehillim is a bracha, not a proof to the fact that Bnei Banim, Harihan Tibanim. So now we lost our proof text. So Gemara says, Umim Arzid Amarit Bebracha Ktiv. Can you really say that it's about a bracha and this principle does not apply? Right? Aval, when it comes to Inyan Dina Lo, but in Inyan Din it's not true. Vatznan. We have our Mishnah. The Mishnah, this is again why we are doing this now, the Mishnah is the Mishnah we had back on Kufnun Zayin. Kufnun Zayin Amar Al was the Mishnah of Nafala Bait Alav V'al, right, Avalav. So over here, the Gemara quotes this Mishnah as the proof text for this situation. That's why this Gemara belongs to that Mishnah. So that's not. Nafala bait alav v'alaviv. Alav v'almorishav. The house fell on him and his father, or him and his bequeathers, meaning someone that who is morish to him. Vaita alav k'tubat yishav b'alchov. and his wife has a ketubat isha claim against him, and he has creditors that have claims against him. Yosheya avomrim, those that inherit from the father say, haben mei tishon, that the Reuven died first, and therefore it went to Yaakov, and then Yaakov died. Why do they want that? Because then Reuven had no property and had no possessions, and they can't make any claims against him. And then the father died, Yaakov dies, and they're going to directly inherit the grandfather, which is exactly our case right here. This is what we're looking for. We're looking for grandchildren who are going to directly inherit their grandfather and bypass the father. This is exactly this case. The creditors say, no, Yaakov died first. And then Reuven died. Why? Because then Reuven inherited his father Yaakov. If he inherited his father Yaakov, they can claim, take money from that, they can take the property out, they can get their claims settled, because Reuven then had property before it passes down to his children, Chanoch Ufalu. My love, what's the case here? Yoshea Av. Who are the Yoshea Av? Boni, that is the children, meaning Chanoch Ufalu, the children of Reuven. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the grandfather Yaakov, the son Reuven, and the grandchildren Chanoch Ufalu. And we say here that it was Nafala Bait Alav, Yaal Banav, and then Yoshea Ha'av come. Who are the Yoshea Av? Yosheav are the grandchildren. Chanoch Ufalu, we're going to inherit Yaakovim. Morishav, what does the Morishav mean? What's the relationship between him and his bequeathers? Is Ache, his brothers. So that would be the case here. We're talking about grandchildren and brothers in the, right, in the Mishnah. If you say this principle, that you come directly from the grandfather, the grandchildren inherit directly from the grandfather, bypassing the father, if you say that's not true, that's only a bracha. That bnei banim harikim banim is just a bracha, not a, you know, halachic principle. When the son dies, when Reuven dies, and then Yaakov dies, my have, why does that benefit the grandchildren? It shouldn't matter then. If you say medina, they only come mikoch their father Reuven, that means it's matter how they inherit. Whether they inherit from their grandfather, or whether they inherit from their father, it all passes through their father. If no matter which way it goes through their father, then the creditors have the first rights to it, and they're not going to get anything. Why do they care what the order of the death is? The order of death will be irrelevant if they're always inheriting from their father. So what is it, right? What does it make a difference? You're only taking your father's inheritance. You're doing nothing but getting from your father Reuven. No matter what, whether it's coming from Yaakov or it's coming from Reuven, it's coming from your father. If that's the case, we get first rights on it, and we're collecting our money before you get it. And the order makes no difference. So that's the case. We have a proof to this idea that Bnei Banim, Harien Kabanim, Medina, from our Mishnah. It says, lo, Yoshea Av, you know what Yoshea Av? Echav, are his brothers. Morishav, those that bequeath to him, Achei Davua, are his uncles. So now, when we're talking about here, the Yoshea Av, who inherits the father? Who inherits the father is his brothers. Yoshea Av, the brothers are the ones who are coming up here. So it's Reuven, who's set to inherit from his father Yaakov. Reuven has a creditor. He's a debtor. He has creditors who are coming after him, but he has no property. So they're waiting for his father Yaakov to die, where he'll inherit the property, and they're going to take it. But sure enough, Reuven predeceases his father, or could have predeceased his father in this case, and then the property goes back. Yaakov keeps all his property. Who are the other inheritors of the property? The other inheritors of the property are his brothers, Shimon and Levi. So Shimon and Levi come along and say, you know who died first? Reuven died first. And Reuven has no children. Reuven has no children, he has no inheritors. Otherwise, it's not irrelevant, because then they're not a party to his Yerusha. Right, so what happens if Reuven dies, he has no children, he has no inheritors? What happens to his property? It reverts back to his father. And then the brothers are the in line to inherit all of that property.
The son's brothers?
No, Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi will inherit Yaakov. Right, so Reuven passes away, who has no children, has nobody to inherit him, it goes back to his father Yaakov. Then Yaakov dies, the inheritors are Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, they're all the inheritors of Reuven's property. So what do they want? They want it to be that Reuven died first, and then Yaakov, because then the property of Reuven goes to Yaakov, Reuven never gets any property, the creditors have no claim. And then the brothers are the ones who now collect everything. On the other hand, if it was the other way around, the father died first, if Yaakov died first, then Reuven inherits the property. After Reuven dies again, after his father, it reverts back up to Yaakov and then to the brothers, Shimon and Levi. But it first went into the possession of Reuven. If it goes into the possession of Reuven, the creditors have a claim. And they can take the money before it goes back to Shimon and Levi. So they do have a vested interest in the order, but we're talking about brothers. And if it's brothers, we have no proof that B'nai Banim, Harehem, Kibanim. Because here we're talking about regular Yerusha. We're not talking about this funky Yerusha where they're bypassing Reuven. We're talking about a simple case. it bypasses Reuven because Reuven never got the property. I mean, that it's not a bypass. He never inherited any property. In the same case, what's the case by the uncles? For instance, if you have Reuven, the son of Yaakov, when he's set to inherit his the possessions of Esav, Esav his uncle. Rishpam explains the case. Zachar Esav Omrim, the brothers of Esav say, Reuven made Tchila, that Reuven died first, Esav made Acharon, and then Esav died second, Anu Yoshim Kol Nechasav, and we're inheriting all of his property. I mean, his uncles basically say, we're entitled to all the property. Kilo Yirash Reuven ben Yaakov Nechse Esav Dodo, Tachat Yaakov. Because Reuven will not inherit in place of Yaakov in the possessions of Esav. Shemait Kvar, because he was already passed away. So you understand the case here, so let's think about it. You have Reuven and Yaakov, his father, and then you have Yaakov, Esav, and all their brothers. So now, when Esav dies, and he has no inheritors, who are entitled to his property? His brothers. His brothers include Yaakov. Now, Yaakov should be one of the brothers to inherit him. Yaakov is now passed away. If Yaakov passes away, what happens to his property? It passes to his son, Reuven. So now, the question of who died first matters. Because if Yaakov died first, then when Esav was, or the property of Esav came to be inherited, who does it pass to? It passed automatically to Reuven, because Reuven now steps into the shoes of his father, and he inherits Esav's property, because he becomes like his father and replaces Esav. So if Yaakov died first, right? Yaakov died first, now Reuven steps in, and he gets property. But if it's the other way around, Reuven died first, and then Yaakov has no inheritors anymore. Reuven's already gone before the Esav's property is available to him. So Reuven dies, and then his father passes away. When his father passes away, now his father has no inheritors anymore because Reuven's gone. And so who's going to be the inheritor of the property of Esav? The older brothers. So now the question is... I'm sorry? The other brothers of Yaakov and Esav, yes. Those other brothers of Yaakov and Esav. So the question will be, do the other brothers of Yaakov and Esav get all of Esav's property? Or is Reuven entitled to a portion of Esav's property through his father Yaakov, and then the creditors get a claim to it? So that's what we're talking about here. Dodo, we're talking about his uncles, are the issue. So that's the question. Gemara says in the end, no. What does it mean, Morishav? Morishav is the uncles, and the case of him and his father is a case where it has to deal with his brothers, not with his children, his grandchildren. If that's the case, we have no proof from our Mishnah about Bnei Banim, Harehen Kibanim. Because again, all the bypassing of the Lukuchot here, and all bypassing of the... Yerusha is not about skipping a generation. It's simply about who was first and who was not first, whether they inherited or didn't inherit. Unless you explain the case of our Mishnah as being grandchildren, then there's a jump, a bypass through Reuven, and that would be a proof to our position that Bnei Banim, Harim, Kabanim, and Reuven is totally out of the picture. But if the Mishnah is not talking about that, we don't have any proof. Right now, that's the end of that sugya. Goes back to... Yeah, that's the end of the sugya that deals with our Mishnah. Now we're going to go back to the Mishnah on Kufnun Chet. Alright, so now the Mishnah, we'll do the Mishnah quickly and the Gemara with it, and then tomorrow we'll finish up the Mishnah on the second half of Kufnun Chet Amud Bet. So the Mishnah says, on Kufnun Chet, Nafal Abayt Alav, Ve'al Ishto, house fell on him and his wife. Yorshia Baal Umrim, does that inherit the Baal, meaning the father, you know, the husband, Isha Meita Rishon. They want the wife to have passed away first, V'achakach Meita Baal. And then the husband passed away. Why? Because the husband inherits his wife. So what they want is that the wife passes away, he inherited all of his wife's possessions, and now they inherit everything from the husband. But Yoshea Isha, the inheritors of the woman, Yoshea Isha would be her, either her children from another marriage, or her father, or her brothers, whoever is it, say that what? No. Baal Meit Rishon. The husband died first. The husband dies first. None of her property went to the husband. He does not inherit her. And then she died. So we're entitled to it. So Beit Shammai Omrim Yachloku. Beit Shammai says they split everything. Everything's split. Why? We have a safek here. Each one has a valid claim. Each one has a strong taina. If they have a strong taina, then Yachloku, let them split everything here, right? Nobody can be Motzim Mechaber Lavaraya. It's Mamon Mutaba Safek. Split it all. So what do we, when we're talking about all, let's discuss what all means. One is Tzon Barzel. You have Nichsei Tzon Barzel, which is the Nedunya, right? The dowry that's brought in, that's written into the Ktubah, that's assessed at the time that he comes in. That's one. Number two is the actual Ktubah, the 100 or 200 zuz of the Ktubah. Plus there's the Tosefet Ktubata, right? The additional amount that's added into the money of the Ktubah. Plus there is the Nichsei Meluk, right? There are the possessions that were brought in where he has no achrayut on them, that he gets to eat the payrolls, but the possession stay in the ownership of the woman. So according to Beit Shammai, all of those are b'safek, and we yachloka, will divide them all up. Whereas Beit Hillel umrim, Beit Hillel says, nechasim b'chezkatam. Right, so the nechasim are b'chezkatam. So you could have read this in the Mishnah as being nechasim b'chezkatam, colon, and that's explaining you what that means. But that's not the way we read the Mishnah. The Mishnah is actually one of the items. Nechasim, meaning nechsei tzon barzel. These are the nedunya. This is the dowry brought in, where they assess it into the ketubah, and he's responsible for that amount. If he divorces her, he has to pay that money back, or if he deceases her, they have a claim against the estate for that money. So those tzon barzel, b'chezkatan, are in their chazakah. What does chazkatan mean? That we'll see in the Gemara. Well, there's a machlokas amoraim about what chazkatan means. Ketubah, when it comes to ketubah, means the 100 and 200 zuz plus the tosefik ketubah. Bechezkat yorshei ha-bal. That stays with the husband. Why? Where is the money now to pay the ketubah? The money to pay ketubah is with the husband. So the woman has a claim in the ketubah that has to be paid. It's like a credit document. She becomes like a creditor. So she is a motzim mechavero. Therefore, we'll leave it in the chazak of the bal. The husband will keep the money because he has yet to pay it. Nechasim and nechnasim yotzim eman. What are the nechasim that come in and out with her? That's nechsei meluk. Nechsei meluk are possessions that she brings into the marriage and leave the marriage with her. He's entitled to get benefit from them, meaning the leasehold on them while they're in the marriage. Peirot, he's entitled to the peirot. But the keren belongs to the woman all the way along. So since the keren belongs to the woman all the way along, therefore they're becheskat yoshea av. They belong to the woman. They're really in the woman's possession, unless you can prove that she predeceased her husband, and then it goes to her husband. So therefore that'll stay with yoshea av, meaning the father of this woman, meaning that her relatives will get the money. So Beit Hillel basically divides it up, and let's look at each case. When it comes to Nichsei Malog, it's really in the woman's possession, so that'll stay with her. The ketubah, the money to pay the ketubah is with the husband, because he hasn't paid the ketubah yet. That'll stay with him. So in Barzel, it says, b'chezkatan. Well, what does that mean, b'chezkatan? So that's what the Gemara discusses now. There's the Machlok Zamarim. B'chezkat me. Right, so that's... Right. But he's responsible for the full value.
In case of a divorce, he would have to give it back to the wife.
But he doesn't give it back, he has to pay the money. He just has to pay the money, monetary equivalent of what she brought in. It's assessed in the ketubah at such and such a price, and he's just got to replace that money. Whether it's through what he gives back to Tona Bazel, or if he pays money, he's got to replace the money. He's got to pay it back entirely.
So we don't know what Bezel is saying.
When the Bechez Katan, whose chazakah is it? Right. So that's exactly the Gemara's question. Bechez Katmi. Whose chazakah is that with? Rabbi Yochanan Amar Bechezkat Yoshea Bal. He says it belongs to the husband. Why does it belong to the husband? Because he's responsible for it. What happens if the property gets destroyed, if property gets lost, or something happens to it, who's going to pay for it? The husband. So that means it's really in the husband's possession. The fact that you are responsible for whatever happens to it is an indication of ownership. Because if you didn't own it, then you wouldn't be responsible for it. The fact is that you have, and it's an interesting issue that came up. It actually came back on Kufman Vavo Menalf. We had to say the same thing with Shevach. Shevach HaKarka, whether it belonged to the husband or the wife. And over there, the Gemara says, because she is responsible to return the money, that we said that makes her an owner. And this goes back all the way back to Manatana, Manat HaHakzir. The Rosh has an interesting sheet over there. The Rosh says that if you're responsible for Gneva and Aveda, that makes you an owner. So that doesn't make so much sense. Why? If you're responsible for Gneva Aveda, you shouldn't be an owner. It should be the other way around. It should be that if you own it, you're not responsible to repay anybody. But no, the fact is that if you are responsible for the monetary replacement of the object, that means makes you the owner of the object itself. So because you don't have to return the land, you don't have to return the actual object, you just have to return its monetary value. So if you have to return its monetary value, you're responsible for its monetary value, that's an indication that you own the item itself, and all you are now on the hook for is the value of the item. So that's what we're saying here again, the same idea. The Rosh has that sheet in Matanah Manat Achzir, the Gemara mentioned it on Kufman Bavad Alf, and here this is the position of Yochanan, is the same thing. The fact is, by Tzon Barzel, these possessions, the husband does not have to return the exact possession. He's on the hook for the monetary value. But what's that indicate? It means that he owns the actual item. He owns the item, he's just got to make up the monetary value. So now, when it comes to here, whose chazakah is the item in? It's with the husband. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan says. It's with the husband, and therefore the Yoshea Baal get it. Rabbi Elazar Amar Bechezkat Yoshea Isha. No, it's the other way around. It belongs to the woman. Why does it belong to the woman? Because she brought it from her father's house. It was brought into the marriage. She's the one who has the most connection to it. Shimon Leokhi, Shimon Shum Bar Kapara, Amar Yachloku, split it. Halalubai and the Yerish, they both have a, as the Rashbam claims, a Tayana Chazaka, right? They have a, both of them a strong claim. Therefore, Yachloko, they should split it over here. So now you have three, Machlokos, basically all three possibilities of what you could have said about Nechazim Bechez Katan in the Mishnah. What is that? Nechazim Bechez Katan is one, either it's Yoshe Abal, that's Rabbi Yochanan, Yoshe Aisha, which is Rabbi Lazar, and then Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish. Rabbi Lakish says it's Shnehem, Yachloko, they'll split it. So all three of these positions. There is, we'll do tomorrow, there's a number of Tosfot deals with the difference between this mission and the upcoming mission, so we'll leave that for tomorrow, why there's a difference in the din. But there is one interesting point or discussion that Tosfot has about, first of all, number one, which is, we have a Gemara in Yevamot, and in the Gemara, our Mishnah in Yevamot, there's a similar machokus between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, better case there with the Yabam. But over there, Beit Shammai says, Tuba goes to the Yorshei Habal. So why is it that, what is the difference in our case over here where the Beis Shammai says Yachloku across the board, and yet in the Gemara in Yevamot, in Acholetz, he says a Ktuba that Beit Shammai does not argue, that he agrees with the Beit Hillel and says it goes to Yoshe Abal. So all the Rashbam over here says is, V'yesh Mefarshim, Yevamot, a Ktuba lo pligi Beit Shammai lo shara. So that's all. The Rashbam just says that it's two different, it's Shnei Shitot in Beit Shammai. So Machlokas in Beit Shammai, how, what Beit Shammai's position was with regards to the Ktuba. In Yevamot, it has a position that, Yevamot, that like Beit Hillel, that it goes to the Yoshe Abal. And over here, it's a different pshita in Beit Shammai, which is that it's Yachloku. Tosfos, the retakes issue, then he says, no, that they're actually two different cases. And it has to do with the circumstances that surround the cases. The case by Yevamot is different than the case over here. Why is that? Because what is Beit Shammai's position with regards to Ktuba? Kol omid gavot ki gavu idami. Anything that has been, could be collected, is as if collected. Is ki gavui dami. It's as if collected. Ah. What does that mean, as if collected? That means if you have a proper claim on the estate, we look at it as if collected. So now when it comes to a husband and a wife, that pass, when it passes away, if the husband passes away, the wife has a full-fledged claim on the estate. Because the husband predeceased her, she has a ktubah, she has a full-fledged claim that she can go and exercise right away. She can exercise that claim, we look at it ki gavui dami, as if it was collected. That's not tried by a case of Yivama. By a case of Yivama, she's not entitled to collect her tuba until she gets nichlas, until she has chalitza from the other brother. So that means that when she, before she gets chalitza, when this whole safek arises, in the case in the Yivamot, when that safek arises, it does not entitle her to her tuba yet. She doesn't have a claim for her ktuba yet. So therefore you cannot say, kigavui dami. So that would be the difference in Beit Shammai's position here and in Yivamot. Here, it's the woman, it's the wife passing away, and the husband passing away. So when the husband passes away, the wife has a full-fledged claim, it's kegavui dami. Therefore, yachloku. They have equal claims to the ktuba, and therefore yachloku. In the case of Yevamot, the Yevama has no claim yet as the ktuba. Not until she, chalitza is performed, does she have a right to collect on the ktuba. If she does not yet have a right to collect on the ktuba, you can't say kegavui dami. You can't say as if collected. If it's not as if collected, then her rights to collect are not going to be considered here. And therefore, in the case of Yevamot, Beit Shammai agrees to Beit Hillel that the ktuba goes to the Yoshe Abal. Because there is no other, there's no alternative claim. There's no offsetting claim to them. So that would be, that's one issue that Tosfos deals with. It's interesting. The second issue that Tosfos mentioned is, why didn't the Mishnah, according to all the opinions, consolidate the cases? I mean, that in the Mishnah, it says, according to Beit Hillel, that the ktuba is with the Yoshe Abal. And by the Mechsei Meluk, it's Yoshe Ahav. So according to Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yochanan, why don't you just combine Tzoner Barzel with one of the other two? You have two different, you have Tzoner Barzel, the Tzoner Barzel should either go with the Nechsei Meluk, or they should either go with the Ketubah, because the conclusion is the same. So why didn't the Mishnah combine them? As here, Tosfos answers, the Ikla Meimar Delo Shavinu B'Tamayu, that the reasoning behind why Tzoner Barzel go versus Malog or versus Ketubah are actually different. The Nichsei Tzom Barzel Enam Kolkach B'Cheskat Yoshe Abal Kmo Ketubah. They're not as much belonging to the husband like a Ketubah. Fishi Nichsei Tzom Barzel Hivya Mi Beita. We know that the woman brought them in here. About Ketubah, Mane Matayim Hu Notein. The husband gives it. It was never from the wife's side. V'afil She'en Ez Kukali Yabam HaKetubah B'Cheskat Yoshe Abal. It's always there. Ulamanda Merchezgad Yoshe Aisha, the one who says that the Tzoner Barzel and the Tzoner Aisha, Lo Shayach Hachad Amitnei B'Hadei Nechsei Meluk. They're not comparable to Nechsei Meluk. Lo Shavu L'Gamrei B'Tamayu. Again, they're not equivalent in their reasoning. De'elu B'Chezgad Abal Yoter, Ve'elu B'Chezgad Aisha Yoter. So that's it. The Tosfos points out that even if you say the din is the same, by Tzon Barzel and Malug, or Tzon Barzel and Ketubah, based on Vinyar of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Lazar, nevertheless, they're not exactly the same. Even though the din turns out to be the same, they're actually from different reasoning, because each one of them has more shaykhut to one of the other parties. I mean, that Tzon Barzel belong more to the husband than, Nifzei Malug belong more to the woman than Tzon Barzel, or the other way around. The Ketubah belongs to the husband more than Tzon Barzel. Therefore, the Mishnah, or Beit Hillel over here, separates out the cases of the Mishnah because of the differentiation in ownership or reasoning behind each of these cases. All right, we'll stop over here.